Well, good evening and welcome to the Kansas City Public Library. I'm Henry Fortunato, Director of Public Affairs. I want to thank you for joining us. Tonight's program is people I deal with who remind me of a root canal. No, that's not right. Tonight's program qualifies as the most ambitious combination platter that we've ever attempted in terms of events, because tonight we're actually going to do six things at once, or at least sequentially. First, we're commemorating the 100th anniversary of the opening of the Panama Canal. Technically, that date is tomorrow, but close enough. Second, we're unveiling, well, we've just done it, right here in the corridor of the Truman Forum, as I'm sure most of you noticed, a brand new original exhibit. It's called Moving Mountains, the Panama Canal, Presidential Power, and the Dawn of the American Century. It was developed under the auspices of our good friends at the Truman Library Institute. It was written by Claire Jerry, designed and by exhibit associates, and funded by our good friends at the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation. This exhibit examines the canal's history from the perspective of presidents from Jefferson to Polk to Roosevelt and Wilson, even Truman and Carter. It will be up for several years. By 2018, we expect you all to have it memorized word for word. Third, with tonight's program, we're doing our part to bring your attention to a truly excellent temporary exhibit and a series of special events at the Linda Hall Library that's called The Land Divided, the World United, Building the Panama Canal. That runs through December 31st of this year. If you haven't been there or haven't seen it, we recommend that you give it a look. But that's only three, I said six. So fourth, in the process of doing that, we're going to give you a sense of the extraordinary connections that Kansas City has with the Panama Canal, a structure, an engineering marvel, which many people consider the eighth wonder of the world. Fifth, and now we're getting to our main event of the evening. You were wondering about that, weren't you? We're presenting a public conversation with Dave Starling, who, before he took the throttle at the Kansas City Southern in August 2010, he was president and CEO. As president and CEO, he spent a decade on or near the Panama Canal, resurrecting and running the Panama Canal Railway. And sixth, because we're a library, and because Crosby and I just can't resist the temptation to throw in a literary reference, whatever the slightest excuse presents itself, we're going to give you a brief riff on palindromes. Palindromes, as you may know, are sentences that read forwards and backwards. Reads the same, forwards and backwards. Now, I know some of you are asking, why would we ruin a perfectly good evening by doing something like that? The answer, of course, is that one of the most famous palindromes ever conceived has to do with the Panama Canal. It's a man, a plan, a canal, Panama, which backwards reads a man, a plan, a canal, Panama. Another famous palindrome concerns Napoleon. It's a statement that he might have said, had he spoken English, when he was first exiled to the island of Elba in 1814. That one goes like this. Able was I, ere I saw Elba, which is... Able was I, ere I saw Elba. Okay, so that's great, I'm sure you're thinking to yourself, but, you know, these palindromes are 100 years old, more than that. What connections do palindromes have with contemporary events? A good question. And I have several answers for you. In 2001, shortly after the 9/11 attacks by Al-Qaeda terrorists, some wag came up with this palindrome that suggested there'd be difficulties in executing a speedy capture of the attack's chief ringleader. It went like this. No Osama soon. Which is, no Osama soon. Well, okay, what about tonight's guest? How does he fit into the palindrome picture? It took me a while, but we have one for him as well. It would be Evade Dave. Which, of course, backwards is Evade Dave. But actually, from what I know of Dave Starling, that's the absolute last thing you'd ever want to do. Dave has had an extraordinary career on several continents. He's got a cargo container's worth of stories about working on the Panama Canal Railway, most of which I think are reasonably true. To tell you more about tonight's guest and conduct tonight's public conversation, please welcome my dear friend and esteemed colleague, Crosby Kemper III.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I am here as a descendant of a man, my great-grandfather, W.T. Kemper, who was a receiver and sold the Kansas City, Mexico, and Orient Railway, which he as the receiver, in effect, owned, because he couldn't figure out how to make money in Mexico. Pancho Villa was one of the problems then. Therefore, it is not only a pleasure for me, but it will be an education for my entire family to ask to come up here a man who has not only made money in Mexico, but also in Panama, Dave Starling. Come on up, Dave. Yeah. Dave, as Henry indicated, is Kansas City Southern's CEO, one of our greatest companies, and he's the former Panama Canal Railroad CEO. And in 2012, Dave Starling was named the Railroader of the Year by Railway Age magazine. Predecessor and as Railroader of the Year in 2001 was Mike Haverty, the former CEO of Kansas City Southern. So it's a tradition here in Kansas City that we have the Railroader of the Year. But most importantly of all, Dave is the man who has a plan both for and in Panama and beyond Panama. So, Dave, we'll get to Panama in a minute, but I want to start out by establishing your bona fides as a true railroader, the kind of guy who does, as you've said many times, is 24/7 on the railway. And so could you tell us a little bit about the moment, which is, I think, important in your career with your wife, at 3 a.m., you got the 3 a.m. phone call about the dying crew.
Well, first of all, some of my neighbors from Kirkwood are here tonight, and my wife is not, so please don't tell my wife this story because she hates it. But as a young superintendent, it was always 7 by 24, so you were on call for any kind of emergency, anything that would happen, and you had the unique ability of taking a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning and you deal with the situation, and by the time you hung the phone up, your head would hit the pillow and you'd be asleep again. And you'd wake up at 6 o'clock and you could remember the whole conversation. So one night, and this is all about railroad terminology. So one night we have a crew that's coming out of Carthage, Missouri, and it's going to Neodesha, Kansas. And we have what we call the federal hours of service, so it's 12 hours a crew can operate. And then after that, they've exceeded the hours and they can't operate anymore. So we call that dying on the hours of service. And then when a crew comes into the station at night and they mark off, or what we call tie up. So they're done with their shift and they've tied up. So one night I get the call and the crew had died on the hours of service. And so I'm talking to the dispatcher and I said, well, you know, go ahead and take the crew in. And I don't remember the whole conversation, but my wife did. So I wake up at 6 in the morning, and I look over. My wife is laying there staring at the ceiling. And I said, what's wrong? She said, well, we got to have a talk. She said, I know that railroading can be a very dangerous business, but she said, first of all, it's terrible that a crew would die. And I don't really understand how that could happen, but why would you tie them up and haul them into Neodiche? So again, railroad terminology can be a problem for people that don't work in that industry.
So it's, you know, that's a good story. So thank you. So old railroaders do not die and go to Neodiche.
We don't die and go to Neodiche.
Well, you know, we're celebrating the Panama Canal's 100th anniversary, but it's also true that the railroad is itself significantly older than the canal. In fact, next year will be the 150th anniversary of the completion of the railroad. And when it was established, it was the first transcontinental ocean-to-ocean railroad before the Union Pacific and completed the Golden Spike, or they had the transcontinental.
I remind my railroad friends of that. We have the true first transcontinental railway.
Right, you do. And how long is it?
47 miles.
47 miles of transcontinental
and
Atlantic.
It's very
to the Pacific.
Angry too. It's an angry 47.
An angry 47 miles. It took a long time. It took almost as long to build it as it did the transcontinental through the U.S. It goes across a continental divide.
Correct.
The Cordillera, is that how you pronounce it, Matt?
Culebre Cut.
The Culebre Cut.
Places
the Culebre.
I actually call Summit.
Summit,
which is
right.
The top of the continental divide.
Right.
You've got to remember, you're only 8 degrees above the equator down there.
Right, so very hot.
Tropical.
And the continental divide, the top of the continental divide in Panama is how high is that?
About 500
feet. 500
feet,
yeah. Okay. But the canal and the railroad happens, and then the canal because an important event. I mean, there was talk about mail service, and they wanted to establish mail service because it was quicker to San Francisco, obviously, to cross the Isthmus of Panama than it was to go all the way around Cape Horn. But the gold rush happened in 1848-49, and then it really became important. And the railroad started to be a very profitable thing once they got it going because of all the people going to California. But
you actually had a steamer service that operated out of New York down to Panama, went across the Isthmus by mule, and then it would catch a steamer and go to San Francisco. And that was the quickest way for the gold rush, for the gold diggers, to get to the West Coast, because otherwise it was covered wagon. The Transcontinental Railroad was not completed until 1869, so Panama Canal Railway, when it was finally built and completed in 1859, it was by far the best route.
Right. So for a little over a decade, it was a fabulous thing to have. There was from the 1850s on, there was discussion of a canal so that ocean-going ships could go through for obvious reasons, cutting 6,000 or 7,000 miles off their journey to San Francisco from New York or from Kansas City, going down the Missouri River and down the Mississippi, but there was competition for it too in Nicaragua and in Mexico, a place called Tehuantepec, I think it was, and the great Lake Nicaragua, which is a huge lake, was fairly easy to cross, and there were people. I have another connection to this business. By marriage, my late wife, Maria Rosa Menocal, one of her great-great uncle, A.G. Menocal, was the leading engineer pushing the Nicaraguan canal route. But de Lesseps, the great French engineer who built the Suez Canal, wanted to do Panama. He was like Roosevelt, was a man with a plan for Panama and a canal. You've been there and spent a lot of time there, Dave. Is Panama the right route versus Nicaragua?
Well, Panama, I'm told, was chosen because, first of all, it's shorter. It's only 47 miles. I think the route across Nicaragua is 127 miles. You do have the advantage of the lake, but it's still a lot further. Also, Panama has no natural disasters. There's no earthquakes. No real typhoons.
And volcanoes. So Nicaragua had volcanoes.
They had volcanoes.
You know,
so
one actually erupted while the Senate committee was was in session trying to decide which one to pick.
But
bad timing.
Needless to say, there was a lot of politics, and I'm sure money that was, property that was purchased and commitments that were made, and a lot of noise about both locations. But I think that Panama by far has turned out to be the most practical route.
And part of the reason, I think, was that the railroad was already there.
The railroad was there. It was completed in 1855. It was built by the Americans. Even though it was a British gauge, it was 60 inches. It was you know, built before Abraham Lincoln established the standard gauge of 56 and a half inches. So it was a wide gauge, but it was a great railroad, very scenic, over a lot of causeway, a lot of water on both sides.
Right, and so. It had to be rebuilt and rerouted once the canal was up and running. And when you got there, you basically had to rebuild it too.
The railroad had fallen into disrepair. In the handover of the canal, the first part of the Carter-Torrijos Treaty in 1979, the agreement was made that the canal would hand over in 20 years, in 1999. So the canal at the time was operating the railroad. So Carter said, well, the first thing that you will receive is we're going to give you the railroad. So the railroad at the time was fairly efficient. It had 110 employees, and within a couple of years, it had 450 employees because it was then operated by the government. A lot of patrimony, a lot of jobs were given.
I think, isn't there a technical railroad term for that? Feather bedding?
Feather bedding, yes. Yeah. So it started a slow deterioration. So by the time Mike Haverty and Mike Lanigan, the two potential concession holders, looked at it, in fact, I think Landon Rowland is here tonight. Landon was on that train with Mike when they went across the isthmus. It was in total disrepair. The rail would literally lift up out of the tie plates and back down again, so it was barely operable. In fact, about 10 years before that, the U.S. government had actually forbidden the canal to use the railroad and didn't want U.S. Passengers on the passenger cars. It was in that bad of shape. So we went in and totally stripped off the top layer of the railroad. We kept what we call a hard pan, which is all of the surface of the railroad, because it, you know, had been there over 100 years. And we regauged it, put in concrete ties, 136-pound welded rail, ballast from Nova Scotia, and we rebuilt it to a 70-mile-an-hour railroad. In fact, there's a gentleman in the audience tonight. He's Missourian. He worked for a company called Neosho, and he came down in 2000, and he was the... You call him a superintendent, the president, general manager, whatever you want to call him, but he and his team actually rebuilt the railroad. In fact, when I saw him here tonight, I said, you ought to be down here giving this talk instead of me. So, Richard Long, would you stand up back there? Yeah. But we had obstacles with permits. We had obstacles with squatters. Panama has two seasons. In fact, the joke was, when I retire, I want to be a weatherman in Panama because it's either hot or hotter, and it's wet or dry because you've got a dry season and a rainy season, and as Richard well knows, you can't do any of the dirt work in the rainy season. So that all had to be done in the dry season. You could build rail. You could lay rail in pouring rain, but you couldn't build that subgrade because you do more damage then you would do good. So Richard and his team did a great job, and within 18 months, we had a railroad that was 47 miles from ocean to ocean, but we didn't have our rail terminals yet, so we started a passenger service, and that allowed us to train our engineers, and then within the next 4 or 5 months, we got the intermodal terminals built, and we were able to open the container service.
And we should talk about the passenger service, because, of course, the railway, the Panama Canal Railway, started as a mail service and then passenger service in the 1850s. A lot of railroads, including Kansas City Southern, were kind of getting out of the passenger business. So there's a well-known story about your taking this idea of the passenger service being revived to the Kansas City Southern board meeting.
Well, there was an airline service that would take the business people that went to the free trade zone in Cologne from Panama City to Cologne every day. And you can imagine during the rainy season that was a little iffy. There'd be a lot of delays because there was only a two-lane road between one side of the ocean to the other across Panama. So the opportunity was to get the airline passengers, and they were paying about $49 to fly over. And if we could get them on the railroad for about a $25 fare, which sounds extremely high, but if you're paying $49, doesn't sound so bad. So we managed to get enough of those people signed up that they would ride a daily passenger train from the Pacific side to the Atlantic side and then bring them back in the evening. So I go to the board meeting, and of course Mike Haverty and our other partner on the board, and I'm explaining to Mike about this passenger service. And Mike starts beating his fist on the table and saying, you know, it took me 20 years to get rid of passenger trains on this freight railroad, and now you're telling me we're going to bring passenger service back. So he definitely was not a believer in the project, and I thought he was going to throw me out of the window of the sixth floor, but we managed to sell the board on the project, and we did open a passenger service.
And you had some fun doing it. There wasn't passenger service then, so you had no passenger cars in Panama. So where did you go to get the passenger cars?
We found some clocker coaches in Delaware that were Amtrak coaches that were in storage. We liked them for two reasons. They were stainless steel, and they were going to a tropical climate. And they had big windows on the side, because we had the idea that this could also be some kind of excursion service, some kind of event train, so we wanted these big windows. So that was our five base cars that we found in Delaware. I think we paid $80,000 for those cars. We shipped them to our shop in New Orleans, and we started a rebuild on those. But we wanted a feature car for the train. So we found we were looking for a full dome, and full domes are hard to find. Full dome has about an 11-foot ceiling in it, so it's a unique car. We found one in Florida at an ice cream parlor. All the wheels were gone. It was just sitting there as a little ice cream store, and we paid $40,000 for it. We put it on a flatbed trailer, and we hauled it to New Orleans. And about $1 million later, we had a very nice dome car. And that was the feature car in the train. And that car, we learned from the fun train in Florida that you got to be very careful with air conditioning in a tropical climate. Because if you can cool it and get it cold enough, but then it becomes a tropical rain shower inside of the car. So this car had 30 tons of air conditioning, but it also had heaters in the car. So when it would get to a certain temperature, humidity would build in the car, the heaters would kick on and burn the moisture up. And that's how we kept the windows clear. And then we had paintings in it, we had a bar in it, and the passengers paid a premium to ride that car. And about that time, the cruise ships decided to call on Panama. So as we positioned our train to the Atlantic side, the cruise ships called on the Atlantic side. They would get on the train while it was at rest on the Atlantic. We would take them across. They would do a tour on the Pacific. We would take them back, $150 a passenger. They called it the Two Ocean Train Cruise. And so needless to say, we didn't get $150. Let me tell you how the cruise lines make their money. It's on those events, not the rooms. So, but we made good money on it, and it was a very unique service, and we had a lot of fun with it. And it still operates today. Unfortunately, you don't have the same cruise ships that are calling, but at that time, we had about 300 cruise passengers on the train on every trip. That's in addition to our daily passenger service.
And so. Lunch on the Atlantic and dinner on the Pacific. Which is great. Well, I want to talk a little bit, Dave, about how you got to this august position of running an ice cream parlor in Panama. You grew up in a small town in Arkansas,
right?
That was a couple of blocks from the railroad. You could hear as it said, the lonesome whistle blow.
I'm gonna date myself, but it was in 1967. I was in a small town in Arkansas. I was a crew change point on the Rock Island Railroad. It was between Hartshorne, Oklahoma, and Little Rock. And a crew change point means that the away from home or the terminals were in Little Rock and Hartshorne, but the away from home terminal was in our small town. So all of the crews would come in, they would get their rest to catch their run back out. So a lot of the families, a lot of the people, small town, 3,000 people. So a lot of those families worked for the railroad. So we considered it a railroad town. And the yard was about two blocks from my house, so I could hear them banging the boxcars at night. And I had a chance at 17 to go to work on the signal gang for the Rock Island for one summer. So that's probably my first taste of railroading. And then I did the smart thing and went away to school. And then in 71, I had the railroad itch again, and I went to work for the Frisco Railway in Fort Smith, Arkansas. I worked as a clerk telegrapher for about 3 years. Then I had a chance to become a train dispatcher and moved to Springfield. That was the headquarters of the Frisco. And I was there 3 years, and one of the best jobs I ever had. I really enjoyed being a dispatcher. You sit down at a desk, it's 11 o'clock at night and 7 in the morning, and you're running your territory. And railroads have a tendency to give you a lot more responsibility than you really should have. So they've got a young guy there that's 23 years old, and this is your railroad from 11 o'clock till 7 in the morning. It was really enjoyable. You got a scorecard every day. You left after 8 hours, and you knew how many trains you'd operated, whether they'd operated on time or not, whether you'd had problems, and how you dealt with it. So that's probably when I was first bitten by that railroad bug.
And you knew you wanted to be a railroader at that point. And so you go to Memphis, and you're a train master. And a train master is what?
Well, you go out and you're assistant train master. That's your first management job. My first real railroad mentor that I worked for there was a gentleman called Hunter Harrison. If you're in the rail industry, Hunter is, as most of us in those days, we started in the crafts. Just like Mike Haverty started as a brakeman. I started as a dispatcher. Hunter was actually a car knocker. He was the guy out in the yard that was changing brake shoes on cars. Hunter later became the CEO of the Canadian National and was there for a number of years, did a turnaround there, very successful. Hunter retired at 65, and then in the last 2 years, 18 months, an activist, made a run at the Canadian Pacific, and they brought Hunter out of retirement, and he's now the CEO of the Canadian Pacific. So to have two Frisco boys that are the CEOs of the two of the class one railroads today is kind of unique, because Frisco was a very small railroad, nothing like these big railroads we have today. Frisco no longer exists. It's part of the Burlington Northern. Of course, the Rock Island went broke. So, when I came to KCS, they kind of looked at me and said, are we going to be okay? You know, we got this.
But you got
Frisco
a lot.
Doesn't exist, and the Rock Island went bankrupt. So
you got a lot of opportunities as you went along. When the Burlington Northern bought the Frisco, you became director of transit and terminals.
And I was in Springfield, and that's when the Frisco was purchased by the Burlington Northern. So I made the mistake as a railroader. We always tell our boss what we don't want to do, and that's the way to make that happen. So I told them that I would go about any place but Chicago. So as a small town southern boy, I ended up as superintendent Chicago.
Right.
And people asked me, my friends in the Frisco said, well, what's it like up there? And I said, well, Chicago, of course, is the biggest interchange point in the U.S. So if you're a railroader, you know, it's really a big operation. And I said, well, it's kind of like the playing for the minor leagues and you get traded to the bigs. So you're suddenly in the major league in Chicago. So it was quite an experience. First time I met Mike Haverty. Mike was, I think, VP of operations then for the Santa Fe. So we met at some customer event, and then I didn't see him again. That was many years later.
And you went international shortly thereafter.
I did. I had a chance to go to work for a company called American President Lines. It was we call them steamship lines, a container ship company.
And which, interestingly, is sort of a descendant from Pacific Steam.
I was reading the history of the company after I went to work, and the precursor to APL was actually Pacific Steam, which was the company that had the mail contract from New York to Panama, and then Panama to San Francisco. That was the start of American President Lines.
So you start to get some international. They send you to the Philippines and to Hong Kong.
We had a chance. My wife and I had always wanted to go overseas, and when I went to work for APL, I'd been there about 4 years, and a job came open in the Philippines. And I'll tell another story on my wife, but she's not here tonight. We had moved about three times in 2 years. Kids had been in all these different schools, and we were in Chicago, we moved to Atlanta, her sister's there, so for the first time she's with family, and of course they decide I need to be back in Chicago. So we go back to Chicago, I'm there 4 months, and I get a chance to go to the Philippines. So I go home, and my wife is unpacking the last box in the bathroom.
Oops.
And I go in and I said, well, it's finally happened. We got a chance to go overseas. And I remember she just sat down and started crying. So I thought, maybe this is a time I just move on, give her a couple of days. And that's exactly what I did. So we didn't talk for a couple of days. And she came back and said, well, if you don't take this opportunity, will you get another chance? And I said, probably not. So we ended up in the Philippines.
Philippines and then Hong Kong.
15 months later, we ended up in Hong Kong and as managing director. And we were there. We were there for the handover. It was a very unique time. We were there when Hong Kong was handed over, if you will, back to the Chinese. And there's an interesting perspective. We as Americans and the Brits made a big deal out of this. The Chinese were very pragmatic about it. The Chinese said, we made a 100-year treaty or a deal. The 100 years is up. We're not going to renegotiate, so Hong Kong's coming back. So if you think about it, I mean, if you were the other end of that 100-year deal and the contract was up, it's time for everyone to come home. And we got a lot of employees that were very concerned. Hong Kong Chinese saw themselves quite differently as mainland Chinese. So the U.S. offered a green card program for multinational employees so they could actually apply for a green card and move to the U.S. And so we had a lot of the employees that applied for it. But as the date got closer and closer for the handover, one of the employees or several of the employees wanted to see if we could offer Mandarin classes because you have Cantonese in Hong Kong and Mandarin in China. So we started offering Mandarin classes during the lunch hour. And we couldn't get a conference room big enough. Everybody wanted to take these classes. So as the time got closer, they suddenly realized that they were going to be part of a superpower. They were going to be part of China. And they didn't sign up to be part of the UK. I mean, they didn't have a choice in that. So as you ask a few of the employees, said, well, we didn't elect the Brits to come in here and take over. So being part of China is not such a bad thing. So it gradually, by osmosis, kind of happened. A lot of the employees that had gone to the States came back. And as it turned out, it was pretty much a non-event. They set Hong Kong up as a SAR, Special Autonomous Region, and the Supreme Court stayed, all of the law stayed, the rule of law did. So I think the employees at the end of the day were very pleased. Now, they still fight for their democracy and their independence.
They just had an election that was pretty...
It's always a battle, but...
adversarial.
I think they're proud to be part of China because, again, they felt like they were a colony of the U.K.
And they were. There was no democracy in Hong Kong until right before the British handed over. But there was the rule of law, which probably is one big difference from the People's Republic. Well, you know, talk a little bit, Dave, about the... you see, as you've gone to these various jobs and became international, you've seen the big changes in the railroad business. I mean, when you started in the late 60s, early 70s, the railroad business was in many ways in very tough shape. It was very heavily regulated, not very profitable. It seemed like an old and dying smokestack industry, I think is a phrase that you've used. But a lot changes. I mean, you get deregulation, which is one big change.
Right.
And then the intermodal thing, which is huge in the global environment. Talk a little bit about the changes.
Well, you know, there were, in the Frisco, I can remember one year we sold scrap to make payroll. So we had unprofitable branch lines we couldn't close. We had too many trainmen on a train. My home state, the state of Arkansas, had what they call a full crew law. You had five people on a train. You had a fireman or an engineer and a fireman. You had a diesel locomotive, but you had a fireman. You had three brakemen and a conductor. So, I mean, you just had too many, or two brakemen and a conductor. So you had five people on a train. Today they have two. So we just had too many regulations. So the Staggers Act, when the railroads were deregulated, the consolidation started to happen. We got rid of the full crew laws. And the railroads became more competitive. Rates actually went down. Railroads were able to make money and spend capital to refurbish, rebuild, get their railroads in better condition. And as that all started to happen, the railroads kind of came out of that smokestack industry. And a lot of people, you know, 20 years ago or 25 years ago, if my two sons had told me they wanted to go to work for the railroad, I would have beaten them with a stick and told them they should think about something else. But it's really changed in the last years because people have realized the railroads today, they're a franchise you can't duplicate. Nobody's going to build a new railroad. Nobody's going to go in. I mean, most of these railroads operate through downtowns, small towns that were built around the railroads. People aren't going to sell their property. You're not going to go build another railroad. So there's been a tremendous amount of money that's been put into our rail system today. So when you look at our railroads today, we have the best rail system in the world that is not subsidized by the government. We don't receive a dime from the government. We're totally independent. That's the way we want it. And we have 136-pound welded rail. We've got concrete ties. We've got 4,400 horsepower locomotives. The railroads are extremely efficient today, and that's the way you're going to move finished autos. That's the way you're going to move raw materials. So, we as a country should be very proud. Of course, I'm pro-railroad, so we should be very proud of our rail system. I mean, it's again, there's no other rail system like it in the world. People talk about the passenger trains in Europe. They're all subsidized. They're all paid by the taxpayers. So, our country would be very difficult for us to have that. We're too large. We've got an interstate system, and we love our cars.
Right. And so you're sitting in Hong Kong, and with this global intermodal thing going on, all of a sudden there is this opportunity in Panama. You're taken to Panama, giving a look at Panama, and talk about seeing Panama for the first time, being offered this job.
Well, Panama was going through a lot of change at the time because, again, the reversion date of the canal was coming. And we as a country had not decided to renew our lease with the country of Panama. So we had 20,000 people in Panama because it was the headquarters of the Southern Command. So you had four bases there. You had the Marines, the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. So it was truly a military town. In fact, most people that I bump into have either transited the canal, any of those in the military, most of them at some point have been through Panama. They were through on a ship. They were there for jungle training. That's where the jungle training took place for Vietnam. It was all in Panama. So we had a huge presence there. In fact, if there would have been a colony that the U.S. would have had, like the Brits had colonies around the world, it would have been Panama. It was this 10 miles wide, 50 miles long, and we owned it. We controlled it. We had our own security. If you were a Panamanian, you couldn't enter that zone. You had to go through the gate and deal with the Americans to enter areas of your own country. So it was truly our zone. In fact, they had a phrase for them. They were called Zonians.
Right, and the Zonians, some of them were two or three generations people living there. In fact, there are even Zonian light bulb jokes, I hear.
When I first got there, of course, you got to realize the Zonians moved down from the U.S. and they're going to run the canal, work in the canal, and they move into a tropical climate. They've got free housing, free utilities. You get a special 15% grossed-up bonus for your tropical allowance. It was a pretty good gig. So the joke was, how many Zonians does it take to change a light bulb? Well, it takes two, one to mix the drinks and the other one to call maintenance. Because they did everything for them. I mean, it was a good gig. So the Zonians were not happy about giving up the canal. But again, some had been there for three generations, and a lot were they were going to leave, and they didn't like it. And by the time we got there, it was angry time. And within a year or two, Panamanians did a great job of running the canal. They continue to do a great job of running the canal. And all of those Zonians that really love Panama are back there. And they really love Panama, and they'll never leave. So it's home. But you had Pizza Huts, bowling alleys. It looked like Little America in the middle of Panama. So
And so one of the questions that people will ask of someone like you who knows this on the ground is when we had the big debate in the 1970s about the hand back to the Panamanians, and Ronald Reagan running for president at that point said, you know, we bought it, we paid for it, it's ours. We built it, we paid for it, it's ours. And President Carter was negotiating the treaty. There were two thoughts, basically. One is the Panamanians won't run it well. And your experience with the railroad might have said, well, yeah, it might have been a problem. But on the other hand, as it turns out, they run the canal pretty well.
They do, and it was already about 95% Panamanian operated when we got there.
Right.
So Alberto Alemán was a Panamanian, but you realize the Panamanians have this love relationship with the U.S. Nearly all the presidents of Panama went to school in the U.S. They send their kids to school in the U.S. The current president's a University of Arkansas grad. There's been a Texas A&M. There's been a Notre Dame. In fact, the joke, they talk about Miami, because a lot of them have condos in Miami. They say, Miami's such a great place, and it's so close to the U.S. No, we had it first. We had it first. So there's this great love for the U.S., but they don't want to be our little brother. You know, they're Panamanians. They've got a lot of pride. They should have. They're very proud of their country. And they stand on their own, and they've done a great job with the canal.
Now, the other question that Reagan brought up at the time was the strategic, the geopolitical thing that in the 70s he was worried about the Russians, who with the Cubans were spending a lot of time in Central America, and so he's worried about what might happen once the Panamanians had it, the Russians might have influence. That's obviously gone away and never happened. But on the other hand, the Chinese now are wandering around Central America and
Nicaragua,
talking about a Nicaragua canal.
We've all read about that. I mean, the expansion of the canal will be finished sometime in 15 or early 16. It's the shortest route. It has all of the port infrastructure that's there today for transshipment. It has the second largest free trade zone in the Americas, or in the world. I mean, I think Singapore is number one. I could be wrong, but it's a $2 billion free trade zone. There's nothing in Nicaragua. There's no port infrastructure. There's nothing. I think that's going to be a very political concessions are going to be given.
Right.
People will make money on property, and the canal will never be built because you could never justify it. I mean, just the expansion is going to be over $6 billion, they think. And that's just an expansion. That's not building the canal.
Right.
And the Panama Canal is 85 feet differential between the sea level. And I think the Nicaraguan is like 100 and some odd
feet. Right,
it's much more. So the lock system you would have to build would be... Richard Long could work for another 10 years if he wanted to go over there and work on that.
Plus, there are volcanoes.
Yeah, there are volcanoes. So
you spent a total of about 8 years, 9 years?
9 years.
9 years in Panama, and then Kansas City Southern called. Mike brought you up here. Well, he didn't actually bring you up here first. He gave you some things to do in Mexico.
We were trying to develop the port of Lázaro Cárdenas, so I became the executive representative for Kansas City Southern in Mexico. And had a chance to travel in Mexico and work on our intermodal product. So that actually got me started. With APL, when I was in Atlanta, we actually started double stack trains from Detroit down to some of the auto plants.
Tell us what a double stack train is.
Two containers stacked on top of each other. Generally, the restrictor on a railroad is the length of the siding. So if you've got an 8,000-foot siding and you can put the containers on top of each other, you can double the capacity of that 8,000-foot siding by stacking them on top of each other. So you took a car and you made a well. You deepened it so you could get the height clearance you needed for tunnels and overpasses. And so that double stack system has been the trigger for what really has increased intermodal in the U.S. If you think about it, you know, we're not spending, as we all know as Americans, we're not spending any money on our highways. We're not spending money on our bridges and our tunnels. And so the railroads are going to take up the slack, to me, on relieving this congestion on the highways for intermodal. A company like J.B. Hunt, They have 70,000 containers. So they are the largest trucking company that does intermodal in the U.S. They buy $1 billion a year of transportation from the BNSF. And then they turn around and retail that. But that, to me, will continue. You're still going to see more intermodal conversion. You're seeing it right here in Kansas City. In fact, if you go down to the Freight House sometime and just watch all the trains that that go by, go to Jack Stack and look out the windows there and see all the containers that are going by from coast to coast. And then the Kansas City Southern, you know, our secret sauce has been we're the North-South Railroad. So when we started 126 years ago in Kansas City and started building south, then we just continued that over the years, and then pieces were put together. We were basically a regional railroad, and you added the Gateway to St. Louis, and you added the Mid-South to Meridian, you added the Tex-Mex to Laredo. All those pieces were put together to make the Kansas City Southern what it is today. It's about 3,000 miles in the U.S., but it's also 3,000 miles in Mexico. And a lot of people in Kansas City don't understand that. About 46% of our revenue actually comes from Mexico. So we have roughly 6,000 employees, 3,000 in the U.S., 3,000 in Mexico. 6,000 miles, 3,000 in the U.S., 3,000 in Mexico. Unfortunately, our railroad goes right down through the industrial heartland. Through it, we cross at Laredo and go into Monterey and San Luis Potosi and Mexico City down to Lázaro Cárdenas.
There are two things about that, that strike me. One is there's been a lot of talk about NAFTA over the years and who the winners are and the losers are, but clearly you're the NAFTA railway, and you're the winner, and Kansas City is really a huge winner in this, both as an exporter and an importer, but particularly as an exporter, I think.
Absolutely. In fact, this is the 20th year celebration of NAFTA. And, you know, we move more yellow corn through Kansas City for Mexico. In fact, I can talk about this because Bill Fellows, the president and CEO of Bartlett, is here tonight, so he said I can talk about his volume.
Bartlett Grain, which is headquartered, is sort of catty corner to this building over here across Maine, is the largest exporter Kansas City has, I believe.
And they will literally run a train a day through the Kansas City gateway to Mexico. And they have receivers in Mexico that receive that yellow corn, and they use it for corn syrup, for sodas, for different products, and then it's a feed product. They raise a lot of white corn in Mexico for tortillas, but they import the yellow corn from this part of the country. So it all comes out of, you know, Council Bluffs and Atchison and Jacksonville towards Illinois. It all comes out of this zone, and it's a huge business. And then we have finished autos that come out of Mexico. We have 9 auto plants on our railroad.
You're taking the auto parts from this part of the world to Mexico where they're assembling, and then at Lázaro Cárdenas, you're shipping finished cars, Cadillacs, the ones that Mitt Romney's family doesn't buy, to Asia.
Well, you'll literally have the raw products, which are sand, things for glass, and then you'll have the parts, which move in containers. So they all go down into Mexico, they go feed the auto plants, and then the auto plants have the finished vehicles. And the unique thing about Mexico is not only can you export north, but as Crosby said, you have the unique ability to export south as well. And it's true, there's Cadillac SUVs out of Mexico that go to China. There's Mazdas that come in through Lázaro Cárdenas that are going to Mexico. Well, what Kansas City Southern does, it really connects Canada and the U.S. and Mexico together. Because whether we like it or not, we are one big trading bloc. And that's going to be our competitive advantage against Asia and Europe. Because that's who we are. And we have a tremendous amount of product. The borders are getting, and forget about immigration, I'm talking about the products that move. There's a tremendous amount of products. Mexicans love U.S. products. When you go to the stores in Mexico, you see a lot of U.S. products on the shelves there. So it's not a one-way trade. It's both ways.
And in fact, isn't the Mexican economy is growing pretty substantially?
It's growing faster than the U.S. And a lot of the manufacturing that was done in Asia is moving to Mexico, which is a huge opportunity.
But labor is still cheaper in Mexico, or is now cheaper in Mexico than
the
it,
than wages
it is in
have
China.
Converged between Mexico and China.
You add labor and transportation.
You have the yuan and the peso. There's an advantage with the peso today. And if you ship a product out of Asia and you want to go to Chicago, it's 25 days. And you're going to ship it in a 40-foot container. If you want to make it in Mexico and ship it to Chicago, it's going to take you 5 days, and it's going to be in a 53-foot container. So it's a huge advantage, and Mexico is going to continue to grow and be more and more important to us as part of our trading bloc.
Yeah, you know, there are a couple of good stories from your days as head of the railway in Panama. I mean, Panama is essentially a jungle,
It's a jungle out there. That's what we used to say all the time. It's a jungle out there.
In Panama, and you're running the railroad through that, and the Smithsonian's got a very large operation there, which was news to me as I was reading about this. And you had some encounters with the Smithsonian. There's the story of the tower.
Well, the railroad operates through a protected zone that belongs to the canal. We're in the canal waters. And then also the Smithsonian has about, when I was there, it was about 450 employees, because Panama is very unique. It's where two oceans join. And you have fresh water that's being dumped into salt water every day. I mean, it's just like constantly flushing the toilet, because you're taking Lake Gatun, this huge waterway, which at one time was the largest man-made lake in the world, until the Hoover Dam was built, and then it became number two. And now with the Three Gorges in China, it's number three.
Yeah, Gatun was built so the canal could be.
Correct.
And
so during the rainy
course.
Season, Gatun Lake fills, and then for the next 4 months, it's constantly flushing out those locks to lock the ships through, and then during the rainy season, it fills again. So it was a very unique place for flora and fauna, and so the Smithsonian set this up, and they had an island in the middle called Barro Colorado in the middle of the canal, and they had a treaty with the U.S. into perpetuity. In fact, that was one of the big items when the canal reverted, and the Panamanians honored that treaty, and so they still have the same treaty with the government of Panama. But we were, we had trouble with all the foliage on our radio communications. So what Crosby's referring to is we're out there building a radio tower, and we were hauling the materials in on a rail car, so nobody could see us. I mean, there was no roadway in. We thought we're fine. Nobody's ever going to bother us out here. So here comes a Smithsonian game warden through, and we don't have a permit to build this tower. So the administrator of the Smithsonian, a great guy named Ira Rubinoff. So Ira gives me a call and says, "We have a problem. You didn't get a permit to build this radio tower, so we got to work this out." So, and Ira wasn't a scientist, but he dealt with them all the time, and they drove him crazy. So he said, "I've got the scientists bothering me, saying, what are we going to do?" So the compromise was that we allowed the scientists to put all of these insect traps on the tower. And so they could come out then every week or so and climb our tower and get the insects out of their traps. And so our tower was okay then. We could continue to...
Never bug you again.
Never bug you again.
Yeah. Thank you. Sorry. One bad one, that's all.
Another great story from the scientists. There was a harpy eagle that was very special to Panama, and it was an endangered species, and it's about 3 foot tall. It was just a beautiful bird. And so they were trying to help these harpies and trying to help them grow. And so we were around these scientists a lot. They'd be on the train, and we'd go to Barro Colorado. And then you had the group that was trying to help the howler monkey. And the howler monkey is about a little bigger than a chimpanzee. And the first time you hear one in the jungle, they make this ferocious sound. In fact, you think, I'm going to get back on the high rail, lock the doors. I don't want to get caught by this huge animal. And you realize, when you finally see it, it's this small chimpanzee. Well, they were both flourishing, but apparently the harpies were doing a little better than the howlers, because the harpies were so big, they could come down and take a howler out of a tree, just pick him up and gone, and that was a great dinner for the harpy eagle. So there was a huge debate on the scientists on what we were going to do now with these two endangered species.
Versus endangered species. Terrible dilemma. So you had fun. You had fun in Panama and in Mexico, and then you became the COO of Kansas City Southern, and
would have been in 2008.
Yeah, and
9 years. My wife said that's enough in Panama.
So finally, you got your wife back to the United States.
Back to the United States. What a great place to land too. Kansas City has been such a great home.
Yeah, thanks. Then almost your first day as CEO, in 2010, you become the CEO. There's Hurricane Alex. And, you know, as Mike Haverty once said, during the good days, it's easy to be CEO, yeah. But the real trial by fire is when you find out if you've got it.
I think I've been CEO about a month, and it's when you find out that railroading is truly an outdoor sport. It really didn't hit the U.S. It kind of came up through Mexico, and we didn't really, you know, weren't that concerned with it here, and it just devastated Mexico. We had six different mainline derailments where we had locomotives that were laying on their side. We had one slide at a tunnel where we had molasses tank cars that buried up in the tunnel. They derail and then continue to go inside of the tunnel. And we literally, it took 3 days we went in with a torch and had to cut them out and pull them out in pieces. And the guys were in this molasses, trying to wade through it to get the cars out. And the problem was the government, because they had roads out, they took all the equipment. So the contractors we would generally use with bulldozers and track hoes and bring those contractors in to help us with the derailments, all that equipment was suddenly gone. So we're still fighting it, and we've been out of service for about 2 weeks, a lot of 60-some-odd washouts. So we're gradually getting it all put together, and we're getting close to opening. And, of course, the auto customers are screaming at us, and we're still trying to run over one line we have called the F line. And the F line runs from Monterey over to Matamoros and goes up. It was underwater, but it was over the top of the rail about 3 inches. And that's just about the limit you can run over. So we had about 4 days that we ran trains over 4 inches. We couldn't see the rail. We would literally run a high rail in front of the train and then run the train through. And we were trying to get as many trains through as we could, but they were stacking up on both sides of the border. We actually embargoed freight into Mexico, which means at origin, you can't load the car and depart it because we can't accept it. So we were backed up all the way into the U.S. But anyway, we thought we were about open. And I was on the phone with Bill Fellows from Bartlett. And again, they run their train a day, so they're very concerned. And we were trying to detour as many as we can. And there was a bridge called the Anahuac Bridge. I'll never forget it. I still have nightmares about it. So the Anahuac Bridge, we just about had it back in service. And we get a call from one of our people that the government had not released enough water from the Carranza Dam, which is above this river, and that the dam was getting to a danger point. They were afraid it was going to burst. So they were going to have to open the gates on the Carranza Dam. And we didn't think a lot about it at first, and they started to let some water out, and we saw the water start to rise underneath the bridge. And then the second warning was, no, there's not enough. They got to open more gates. So I have one of my guys call me, and we'd actually had put a camera up in a tree, and we could watch the work on our computers on this bridge at Anahuac. And the river rises to the point, the debris comes about, and just takes out one end of the bridge. And so a 60-foot span just drops down in the water. And I'm sitting there looking at this, and I call Bill Fellows, and I said, well, you're not going to believe this, but we just lost a bridge. And so it was so bad, our competitors had it on their website. So they were showing our customers why they needed to route away from us onto their railroad, because we would never get this bridge back in service. So we brought divers in from New Orleans, and they went down and found that beam. And fortunately for us, it wasn't wrinkled, it wasn't bent. And we managed to get that beam up out of the water, and as the water receded, we swung it into place, and we opened on a Saturday night, but we were out of service for 21 days, and that's just almost unheard of. But it took us about, we had the train stacked up on both sides, and it took us about 3 days to start to get fluid, and then about a week to get on schedule again. But I never want that to happen again.
Right. Yeah. But you kept your best customers. Is the good news.
The experience you don't want to have.
Yeah. Well, but over this period of time, you're named Railroader of the Year in 2012, and Kansas City Southern has gone from strength to strength. But from a profitability point of view, growth point of view, one of the most successful intermodal operations, and very successful in Mexico. Will this continue?
I call it the rail renaissance. I don't really see anything that's going to change it. We're a network today. There's 7 class ones, counting the Canadians. And then we have a lot of short line partners, and they've consolidated as well. Some have stayed as short lines, but we call them super regionals. But I just, I think we're very fortunate to have the whole rail network we have in the U.S. and Mexico and Canada. And we've truly made, this one big trading block. But I don't really see it changing. And Kansas City is pivotal. Kansas City is the second largest interchange point by tonnage in the U.S. It's mainly because of the coal and grain. But it's, and the city fathers here, I don't know who they were. Some of you may, but all the flyovers that were built over the years have kept Kansas City from being an area of congestion because the railroad literally goes over the top of Kansas City. I mean, you see these flyovers are just magnificent.
Those are the bridge flyovers, not the people going from New York to L.A., just so we're clear about that.
Because Chicago today, because of all the growth, is literally a gridlock. So it's become a real difficult point to get traffic through. But Kansas City has remained very, very fluid. So you got a good rail system where you have all the major lines. We're not the largest. BN and UP are much bigger than we are here. But since it's our headquarters, we still like to be known as the hometown railroad. So,
but Dave, this is kind of an extraordinary story because really the vision that de Lesseps had and Teddy Roosevelt had of connecting the two oceans, you've really accomplished that with the Panama Railway. The vision that Arthur Stillwell, who was the founder essentially of Kansas City Southern, but also of the Kansas City, Mexico, and Orient Railway, where he had the vision of getting to the Mexican coast at a place called Topolobampo.
Right.
He never quite made Mexico happen. Nor did my great grandfather who took it over from him, but you and Mike and the Kansas City Southern crew have really done it. You're really, if I may say this, the engineer of that vision. You've made it happen.
Well, it's been a lot of people to put it together, but it's again, we're the North South Railroad, so that's been NAFTA has been very good for Kansas City. It's been very good for railroad. I think it's been very good for the U.S. And I think people will see it's better now than when NAFTA was first signed. I think it was misunderstood. But I think today that people understand it's very good for our country.
Well, that is great. And I'm going to end the conversation there, but we have time for, I think, 3 or 4 questions. We have two microphones up here up front. If anyone would like to ask Dave a question about the railroad or NAFTA or intermodal or why maybe instead of paying attention to new terminals at the airport, maybe we should be building intermodal rail and truck facility. Political comment. Yes, sir.
Dave, thanks and congratulations on your new position at Kansas City Southern. Mike did a wonderful job and you're going to do a better job, I'm sure. I've been through the canal several times, both in military and private. It's a very exciting area of the world, literally. It is one of the 7 wonders or 8 wonders of the world. I've lived and worked in Mexico as well. I'm very familiar with Totolobampo. I've been there. and Lázaro Cárdenas. My question is, and I'm also going to qualify this, I'm also a co-chair of this Sister Cities Commission for Morelia.
For Laredo, okay.
Morelia, Mexico.
Morelia, okay.
Your train goes right through it.
Yes, it does.
It also goes through the state of Michoacán, which is the bastion for the cartels. What impact has this had upon your private business?
We have about 1,100 security people in Mexico. Our budget in Mexico for security is about $22 million. In the U.S., I have 9. So it definitely has been an issue. But we've made it an advantage because the tight security that we have on our railroad, we have not had any problems. Our claims ratio in Mexico is as good as it is in the U.S. So what it's caused is a lot of the truck traffic to want to move by rail simply because once you load it on the train, it's really hard to stop it. So we don't have anybody stopping our trains and robbing our trains. So, you know, we have a director of security that used to was a Delta Force, and his idea is push them away from us. If there's going to be a problem, it's going to be the other guy, and it's not going to be us, and it's been very successful for us. So we don't really have any customer issues in moving the freight, and I know what you're talking about in Michoacán, and we've had Lázaro Cárdenas and other hot spots over time, and they really have not bothered the railroad. And I think it's because we're very diligent. We make it tough for them. They did change the laws in Mexico. We were part of that, that if you do rob the train or disrupt the train, that that is a felony. And our strategy, our intent in Mexico, if you rob our train, we're going to put you in jail.
Yeah, robbing the train in Mexico wasn't a felony before?
No. Well, disrupting the service.
Disrupting the service.
Disrupting the service. And we're going to take you to jail. We're going to put you in jail. We're going to have all our resources, and we're going to prosecute. A lot of people just don't prosecute. And if they don't prosecute, they keep coming back and back and back. But it has not been a big problem for us, I'm glad to say.
But we pay.
We do pay for security, so.
Well, it looks like there are no more
questions.
We've
worn them out, so.
Absolutely. Well,
they must be going to, let's see, Santana.
The Rod Stewart concert tonight. Yeah, yeah. I want to thank you, Dave, for everything you've done. You know, there are dreams of a Pacific century, and there's a double meaning to that. And I think the kind of commerce that Kansas City Southern has been a part of is part of what makes that maybe more than just a dream. So thanks for being here. Thank you all.
Thank you.